I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, I'm Johnny Owen, and this is the Best 11 podcast from TalkSport. Mark Webster and I ask our guests 11 questions all about their love of football, from their earliest memories of the game to how their matchday rituals have changed over the years. And at the end, they'll tell us their best 11, a team made up of anyone who's ever played for their club, along with a manager of their choice. Will they force players from a different era into a 4-3-3, or will they keep it simple with a 4-4-2? We'll find out very shortly. Our guest today has one of the most impressive CVs you can have. He's a rock star, he's a writer, and one of the most important people in late 20th century football culture. Founder of the legendary and era-defining End fanzine, he's also an all-round smashing fella. It's the marvellous Pete Hooton. Pete, welcome to your best 11. Can you start by telling us who you support and why?
My team is Liverpool Football Club, and I support them because of my family, really. My granddad was a Liverpool fan. He lives right opposite the Kop in a place called Granton Road. And my dad was a Liverpool season ticket holder since the 1960s. So the very first memories I ever had was my granddad kicking a ball and trying to show me how to play footy, you know, unsuccessful. So he used to be a bit of a footballer, you see. I've got a great photograph of him, 1906, 1907 season, winning a trophy in the Anfield area.
Oh, wow. So you're literally, but you were born to be a Liverpool fan, really, Pete, weren't you?
Well, I think that they're my first memories of football. And, you know, it's one of those when your granddad and your dad support a team, you're not really going to go against them, are you?
No. Well, that goes Liverpool.
There were some Evertonians in my family. My mum's side of the family tended to be Evertonians, right. But my dad's side were all Liverpoolians, you know.
So the male gene was more dominant with Pete Hooton.
That's it, yeah. And, you know, because they live by the ground, that's my earliest memories of crowds going to the match. And my dad used to park outside my nan's. So she'd put, like, the chairs out or the step ladders. And if anyone tried to move them, there was murder.
Do you remember the first game you went to?
Well, I don't really, because I remember the incident because my granddad took me in. It was a reserve game. And he took me because in those days you could get into reserve game if you had a season ticket. So he got into the reserve game, but he took me on a crash barrier and I fell off and split my head open. There was no one else around, of course, because it was a reserve game. But that was my first memory. But my dad used to work with someone called Ray Shelley. And Ray Shelley's dad was the trainer, Albert Shelley, in the 50s and 60s, and he was still hung around when Shankly came, even though he wasn't paid. He was one of those people who wore one of those brown, you know, overcoats.
Right. Yeah.
And just an odd job man, boot room boy, you know, used to fix all the boots and that. So I don't think he was even getting paid in the 60s, but he was still there. And he'd get the odd ticket for me. My dad would get me the ticket, and we'd go in the obstructed view right next to the cop. In the main stand, but right next to the boys' pen. And the boys' pen, if anyone remembers boys' pens in those days, they were jungles.
Yeah.
So all through the match, you'd be getting pelted.
They were.
Not only were you in the obstructed view, you know, you were there. There was no one around you because it wasn't the days of sell out all the time, you know. So you'd be sitting there, I'd be sitting there with my dad. But my dad had a season ticket, you see, for the Kenman Road, which was built in, I think, 62, 63 season. So when he got tickets off Albert Shelley, you know, he'd come in the main stand with me. And my first time, I remember going to a game independently. I went in the Anfield Road a couple of times opposite the Cop, and then I thought it was big enough to go in the Cop. So I went into the Cop, and it was early 70s, and it was Liverpool played Man United. And it was a 2-2 draw, but I went in the Cop, but I wasn't big enough, obviously, so I had to sit on one of the crash barriers. I got pushed off the barrier and had to be lifted. It was a tradition in those days. Women and children, if they were in trouble in the Cop, they'd be lifted over the heads and sent down to the front.
Right.
And that's what happened to me, to my eternal Shaheen.
you went crash barriers, not getting on,
yeah,
Peter.
Yeah, his early Spain career, falling off of crash barriers.
So it did happen to me mum in the 50s. She consisted to the match with my dad, because my dad and his mate were going to the match. He said, oh, we'll come with you, me mum and sister. And the same thing happened to them. They were in the middle of the Cop and they had to be passed over the heads, you know, so it's a family tradition.
Being dropped at your head at Liverpool.
Brilliant. Pete, do you have you remember those early days when, I suppose, when Shankly would have been there, and Liverpool would have been one of the best teams in the country, if not Europe. But did you have a favourite player as a kid?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say, I thought about this long and hard, because there's some great players in the 60s, but I can't really remember them that well. You know, I see footage of them and that, but for me, it was the second Shankly team that I started going regularly, like, and it was a toss-up between Keegan and Toshack, and I've gone for Toshack because I saw him in a nightclub once a few years later, and he was absolute dynamite on the dance floor.
He was a big, handsome lad, wasn't he, Toshack, in the day?
And well,
when he arrived, it was like a film star coming, yes. You know, Toshack. He was like, had the beautiful wife, looked like Britt Eklund, you know, and Shankly arrived at Lime Street to meet him, and he wore his Mac and his trilby, because he thought trilbies impressed people. If he ever went to the FA on a disciplinary, he always had his trilby on, because he said he looked like a Chicago gangster. And he could maybe intimidate the FA, but sure. Obviously he met Toshack to impress him with his trilby on, and I've got a great photograph of it, you know.
It's interesting because he was obsessed with the old James Cagney, wasn't he? That was his idol.
Yeah.
The old Dirty Rats. And the great thing about Toshack, he was his own man, because he went out to Europe and just owned that as well, didn't he? He had a great life out there as a player and a manager.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a very skillful player, even though he was known for his aerial ability. But you know, Keegan obviously was dynamite. He absolutely transformed the team, you know. But I think there was a match against Borussia Mönchengladbach, which was actually the match went ahead, and Toshack had been left on the bench, or hadn't been picked, and
right.
He went over the hoof.
Yeah,
it was rained off. It was torrential rain, believe it or not, in monsoon Liverpool, and Toshack had gone off in a strop, but Shankly picked him for the following night. To get, you know, and like Liverpool hadn't done anything on the first night. After half an hour, it was 0-0. But as soon as Toshack played with Keegan, you know, it was like Toshack, Keegan, 1-0. That was the famous one, wasn't it? You know?
Yeah, yeah. I got a great Toshack story that kind of sums him up for a lot of people. A really good friend of mine, Di Griffiths, is the kit man for the Welsh national football team. And he was the kit man for Toshack. And he said when he first joined as the Wales manager, the first time I met him, we all met for a big meal. And when the meal was finished, Toshack got up and Di said, I was sitting next to him, and he offered him his back. And Di said, I sort of looked at him and wondered what he's on about. Of course, he went to sort of put my jacket on me.
Yeah.
And he kind of said, I did it. I couldn't help doing it. You know, the James Brown leaves the stage.
Please,
he said, I did
please,
that. He said, but he's got
please.
That presence. And he said, I always did it. I always ended up putting the jacket on Toshack. He was that kind of bloke. Do you know what I mean? And he said, I don't know why I did it. He said, but I always did it.
With
said,
his cane.
Yes,
and
he
his
was
back.
Almost like that was the kind of like the presence he had. Anyway, we've talked a lot about Liverpool as, you know, that great team of the 70s that you kind of remember, the second Shankly team. What were your rituals, your matchday rituals, Pete, when you went to Anfield at that time?
Well, it was always walking across the park, really, and getting to my nans. I used to go to my nans. They'd moved slightly a bit further away from the ground, only, you know, a few hundred yards, but used to go and have me dinner there, maybe, and then get in early, because you had to get in early in those days, because obviously if you were trying to get into the cop, you know, for the big games, there were lockouts. And if you were a kid like me, we always tried to sit on this one bar. The bar had been couldn't get back onto against Man United, but eventually, as we got a bit older, that became our bar. And it was more or less just away from the middle of the cop. There was like two-thirds of the way up the cop, there was like a walkway. Even though it looked like solid, the whole cop, there was a bit of a walkway, and it was the first barrier down, and that's where we used to go, you see. And it became, you'd have to get there at 1:30, you know, sometimes, you know, an hour and a half before the game to actually get in. And I always remember there was some, you know, scenes outside of it. I always remember the distinctive smell of the horse manure and hot dogs. That's all I can remember. Those smells, like, I mean, most football grounds had that, but it was always trying to get in, for especially when we won the league. Shankly's second great team, you know, I think it was against Leicester we won the league. It was 0-0. But it was really hard getting in that day, you know, because the amount of people outside. But when Shankly came onto the pitch after the game, and there's really brilliant footage of this, it was like he was the Messiah, you know. And I think I've never witnessed before or since a communion between a crowd and a manager like that. And he went round, it took him about half an hour to do the lap of honour because so many kids were jumping on his back. And I remember a policeman, there's a famous footage of the policeman kicking a scarf away. Someone had thrown a scarf from the car, and he picks it up and says to the policeman, "That's somebody's life."
Oh, you know? He had a way with words.
It's a great line.
Can I ask, Pete, because I've never really had the opportunity to ask this, watching a game of football from the cop, we can see from a distance, you know, what the experience is like, but is it easy to watch a game, follow the game of football in there?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, certainly in the 70s and 80s when it bigger crowds, you know, and it was Terrison. Sometimes it's a bit difficult if someone like Peter Crouch stood in front of you. Like, it was fairly easy to watch, and there was a feeling there of, you know, it was a swaying mass of people.
Yeah.
And there's that brilliant footage from the 60s where someone from the BBC goes and they're all singing "She Loves You" and "Anyone Had a Heart" and all that. I was a bit after that, so the crowds weren't as big because they reduced the capacity of the cop. But it was still a great vantage point to see it. Yeah, it was fantastic.
And what about now, Pete? You still going to the cop now? What are your matchday rituals?
Yeah, I'm still a season ticket holder. Whether I'll ever get back there, I don't know. But I'm still a season ticket holder in block 306 in the cop, which is more or less where I used to sit on the cash barrier.
Wow.
You know, so it's right in the middle of the cop. And we've been going there since 2007 in the same area, a few hundred of us, and they let us stand there, you know. I mean, it's unofficially, but they just let us stand there. And we all look forward to going down at half-time, you know, and going into the concourse. I think everything's going to change now, though, obviously, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because of capacities. The whole thing about football for me was the social side of it as well, before and after. And I think, obviously, that's going to be curtailed a bit, you know.
Well, some of the pubs before, you know, in Liverpool are almost as famous as the Cop, you know, the Arkles and the Yankee Bar and those kind of places. Did you have a place you went to before the game, Pete?
Well, I go to one now called the 12th Man. It used to be called the Salisbury, but everyone knows it as the Solly.
Yeah.
And it's been changed the name to the 12th Man. It's right, you know, a few hundred yards from the Cop. So we always go there, yeah. In the 80s, we always used to go to a place on just off Scotland Road, which is called the Jester.
Yeah.
That's where we used to sell the end and things like that. But now that's a funeral parlour.
No, it's a funeral. Well, I do like the symbolism of that, yeah.
I just want to quick chat to you about quickly about the end. Because we get so many emails and people mentioning it. I mean, it's quite difficult when you're the person who's kind of one of the founder editors. But did you possibly imagine the effect that would have on football, really, at that time?
No idea, really, because it wasn't really a football fanzine. It was just an observational fanzine of, like, things that we found funny. So what we'd do is we'd go to the pub and think up ideas for various stories. So I saw it as, like, it was just a satirical magazine that it just took the mickey out of everyone, you know. It upset a few people in Liverpool, actually, because, you know, there was radio DJs who were always getting attacked. And there was one called Billy Butler, who was a famous Evertonian. He was on Radio Merseyside up until recently. And he challenged us. He said, come in and I'll do an interview. And we went in to do an interview with him in the Holiday Inn, believe it or not, which was on Paradise Street opposite Radio Merseyside. And his musical knowledge was unbelievable. So, and he got the ailing. So he was a mate for
him. Oh, he wins.
I mean, John Peel was a big champion as well. That's when it kind of, it went national really, when figures like that got behind it.
As soon as John Peel started mentioning it, it went national. And he was wearing N T-shirts on Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
And there was also something called the Oxford Road Show, and he invited us in for that. And there's still footage of that, of a very uncomfortable five lads appearance, didn't know what to do. But he said it was about the stuff of life. He said music, football and beer, you know.
Yeah.
And he said the reason he wanted to meet us is because I remember sending him a very nasty letter. It was a rude letter, really, you know, saying, taking the mickey out of his show, really, saying, believe it or not, John, you know, Georgian folk music isn't popular on the council. So we became friends after that, you know, but we used to take in the match and he'd bring people from the BBC sometimes. And when Brighton beat Liverpool in the FA Cup, Jimmy Case was playing for Brighton, I think, and he went to record the cup, but it was during the 80s, so it was like there wasn't as much singing as there being from we can remember. And, it was hard to get any sounds really of singing because everyone had gone too cool to sing.
I remember that.
Yes.
Stand to the side and let the young idiots in scarves sing.
Yeah, but there were also I think contributing factors to non-singing in those days.
And the fashion, he was sort of more showing off.
And of course, you know, whatever way you were warming up for the game. Can I just ask a quick question just for this might be to this side. We're going to be talking to Terry Farley on Sunday. You and Terry Farley have a sort of an interesting relationship, don't you?
Yeah, well, Terry was, he used to write to the End religiously about fashion, basically, football fashion, you know, and he'd be saying, you know, Liverpool went down to the FA Cup in 82 at Chelsea. He said, I couldn't believe the number of well-dressed lads with Liverpool, you know, or the scallies, he called them, you know, we call them scallies at the time. He said, you know, Chelsea, we've only got about 50 who dress like that, you know. And he was like, he said, but I don't think we could ever do a magazine like The End because of the reputation of Chelsea. And he didn't think people would accept it. But they started Boyzone. I think at The End, they've said on record saying The End was the inspiration.
Yeah.
And Boyzone actually became bigger than The End, though, which, you know, because that was more club fashion and football fashion. And it was a brilliant magazine. And because of it, we got in touch with him again and said, do you fancy remixing some of the farm stuff? And really, Terry and Suggs they changed our perspective really on things. You know, and Terry was introducing us to various mixes and different dance loops. And he said, this will work. This might work with All Together Now. This might work with Groovy Train. And he was right.
Yeah.
So we'll have to thank him for that, you know.
As soon as the King's Road got hold of it, you see, Terry, it's all over.
Well, did you know, it's a funny thing if Mark would say that, because I think it used to be on sale in places like, it was a place in Charing Cross Road, wasn't it, that sold loads of fanzines and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's where you'd see old copies.
Soccer Pages.
I think it was called Soccer Pages. My mate, Mark Evans, because of The End, he founded Dial M for Merthyr, which still going and is a legendary fanzine. And like I said, he ended up as, you know, one of the main guys of the Wales Football Association, and because of The End, and I remember him bringing it back to South Wales going, you've got to read this magazine. Do you know what I mean? It's amazing how the right people sort of got that, Pete, really, wasn't it?
A lot of people in the past have said, you know, they encouraged them to write.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we interviewed people like Jimmy Boyle, you know, and people like that.
Who, you know, being
one of the most dangerous prisoners in Scottish prison, and his life was transformed by sculpture, wasn't it?
That's so, right, yeah.
The End was very popular in Her Majesty's Institution.
Captive audience, yeah, I argue.
The number of poems we had sent from prison by people saying, I've never done this before, but I think you won't laugh at us, you know.
Yeah.
It was great because it encouraged the working class to write, really. That
absolutely.
Was what it was all about, you know?
Brilliant. Pete, have you got a favourite piece of memorabilia or a memento?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got a few. I've got Razor Ruddock's boots here.
Have you?
He didn't deserve to play for Liverpool, so they're not going in.
I'll tell him.
He was a testimonial, and we were miming on the pitch at half-time, but before the game, there was a celebrity match in there. I didn't take my boots or nothing, but Sammy Lee said, Peter, you've got to have a game at Anfield, you know, you won't get another chance. So I said, I haven't got any boots. He said, well, here's Razor Ruddock's. And believe it or not, for a very big man, he had very small feet. I got the boot there and the 8.5. I couldn't believe it. Wow. And I take 9.5. And I played for Celtic, actually.
Nice.
And Jimmy Johnson, Jinky, was playing next to him. And could I get the ball off Jimmy Johnson?
Wow.
No one ever got the ball off Jimmy Johnson.
And I said to Alan Hansen was playing for the Liverpool team. And I said to Alan, I said, look, if I get the ball, Alan, just let me ghost past you. Please. And he just went, F off.
Of course he did.
The best game of football Neil Ruddock's boots ever had. There you go.
Yeah.
My dad's 65 scarf as well.
Yeah, lovely.
I've got a brick from Glenbuck, from Shankly's house.
Oh, wow.
Went up to Glenbuck a few years ago, and his niece said that's where his house stood, and there was a pile of bricks, so we all took the bricks, so it must have been from himself. But I think it'd have to be the Farm Subito team.
Nice.
Oh, superb.
We're the only group that Subito made the team for. They did make figures for the Beatles, but there were four figures, Subito figures with guitars.
Right.
But
no,
ours was the only Subito team that was named, you know. So we had the colours of Spartacus. So it's basically, it's like the Saint Etienne kit.
Nice.
So it's a green shirt, white shorts and red socks, you know.
What an honour.
That's fantastic,
that is,
isn't it?
About as good as it gets.
I think that's our best one yet.
That's superb. I can't believe it. That's
honestly,
great.
It is.
Peter. It's very fashionable now for groups to be into football, isn't it? But, you know, I don't think in those days it was only the likes of the House Martins.
We were talking about this.
I think you were the first. I mean, there was obviously the lead singer of the House Martins. And I know sort of Norman has said since that he's a Brighton fan, but. I think, he was a Sheffield United fan.
Sheffield United, all right.
But okay. You were the first band that I remember going, we like football, because it was, you were actually warned a lot of the time, people say, not to say you like football.
Because you put
your audience off, don't you?
I think what had happened is that people had seen what had happened to the Cockney Rejects.
Yeah.
Yes.
The Cockney Rejects, you know, went round saying they were West Ham fans, and people were doing timers on how long the gig had last.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Liverpool, it was into two songs and it was over. You know, there was a in Manchester the same, you know, so because I think they used to wear like West Ham shirts on stage, you know, and I thought, even though we want to encourage football fans to like the group, we don't want to be that, you know, insular and people say, you know, we're Liverpool fans or we're Everton fans or whatever. I mean, there's three Liverpool fans in the group and one Evertonian.
Yeah.
Roy, the drummer, is Liverpool, and me and Steve, the guitarist, and Keith Mullen is the Evertonian, 3-1. That's about the ratio in the city, believe it or not.
It's a bit of a myth, like Manchester, that everybody in Liverpool supports Everton. It's not. It's split. But you probably would
When I was a kid, Johnny, when we used to walk to my nan's, Priory Road, just outside Stanley Park, was when Everton had just won the league. It was 1970-71 season. And there was like 30, 40 coaches all from all around the country, Wales, Ireland, Scotland, to see Everton.
Yeah.
And when Liverpool played, we had about two or three coaches. And I always used to look at them thinking, will we ever be as big as them?
Really?
Yeah, one day though, Peter. One day.
Yes. You backed the right horse there, didn't you?
I think obviously the success of Liverpool in the 70s in Europe changed everything, you know.
Yeah. And also the cop was such a striking thing to see when you're a kid on television, and the song "You'll Never Walk Alone," and it was a potent mix really to reach out to kids all across the world in it, and go, that's the club I want to support, isn't it?
When I was going in those obstructed views in the main stand, I mean, I used to just look at the cop and I was just mesmerised by it.
Yeah.
Because in say a night match, isn't that, there'd be steam rising from it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And the song's spontaneous, you know. And I think there's a song Liverpool fans used to sing, "You Got Your Education from the Cop," and people did believe that, you know, that they were one step ahead, you know, whether fans would say, oh no, because there was a great book by Adrian Thills a few years ago, "Sing When You're Winning," I think it was called. And he sort of documented the rise of football songs, you know, and there's some brilliant songs from all different teams all around the country, you know.
You're listening to the Best 11 podcast from TalkSport.
Do you have a favourite player at the moment?
It's a toss-up between Mane and Van Dijk. Mane, right. Because I think he's unplayable sometimes. You know, I don't think he knows what he's going to do himself.
Yeah.
You know, it's like unbelievable. But I think I'd have to go for Van Dijk, because he's just so cool, and you know, I just know he's got a better record collection.
Yeah, so Toshak's a better dancer. See where you're coming from, Pete. He's the game changer as well, do you not feel? Or the catalyst, perhaps, for this contemporary Liverpool success, Van Dijk?
Yeah, undoubtedly. I think, you know, everything comes from him, doesn't it? The calmness of the team. I think Alisson's also very important in the jigsaw, but Van Dijk, you know, he transformed Liverpool, and I don't think people realised how good he was, you know, because I'd seen him. My mate's lad had been on loan from Everton at Motherwell, so we went up to see him. We saw Van Dijk and we thought, why isn't he playing for, you know, someone in the Premier League? You know, no disrespect to, you know, Celtic and that, but you just thought, you know, he's world class, you know. Everything he does looks so effortless.
Yes.
Yeah, he's a great player. Pete, this is going to be a tough one for you, actually, I can imagine. But have you got a favourite ever Liverpool kit?
Favourite ever Liverpool kit? Yeah, I think it was before Liverpool were the first team to have sponsorship, weren't they? Yeah. Famously.
Hitachi, was it? Hitachi?
Crown Paints.
Crown Paints first, that's it, yeah.
Not quite as glamorous as Hitachi.
No.
Crown Paints.
It was.
There's a very funny photograph of Paisley with a paint tin and a painted overall. You know, you can see he doesn't want to be photographed.
No.
Whereas Shankly was the opposite. He wanted to be photographed. He was photographed with everyone, the Beatles, Red One, Black, everyone. But I think Paisley was, you know, shy, wasn't he? He didn't want that type of photograph. But I'd say before that, the early 70s, you know, kit. I mean, the 60s kit was brilliant, but the early 70s kit was just getting into the modern era, so I'd say that, you know, 72, 73 kit. That
so, like a white V-neck sort of thing?
Short V, was it?
Short V, plain, with just a Liverbird. Would that have been a white Liverbird?
Yeah. No paraphernalia.
Do you know, it's a real thing with us, our generation. We hate the busy kits, don't we? But then if you have a plain one, all your kids complain, that's boring, I didn't get it. And I'm like, that's class.
I want the real kit. I don't want this thing.
I know, yes. It's really interesting. Pete, here's an interesting one that always people have a little ponder on. Have you got a team other than Liverpool that you've got a soft spot for?
Well, when I was a kid, it was probably Celtic because we used to sing at the match, Celtic Rangers, and then Liverpool at the end of it. But I suppose I always looked at the Celtic results, really, you know, and I saw that coming up through the 70s. But I wouldn't say, I mean, my mate started coaching Hibernian a few years ago, so I changed allegiances.
That's allowed on your second team. Yeah, that's perfectly reasonable.
Well, if you used to say a best team that wasn't mine, I'd always go for Brazil 82.
The greatest team never to win the tournament, as the saying goes.
You still see footage on YouTube of it, and it's a work of art, and it's beautiful. But I think it changed the face of football because they didn't win that tournament.
Weird, isn't it? Yeah.
Brazilian football changed after that. You know, Telly Santana, they were all broken men, weren't they? Because
it became more pragmatic, didn't it? Because it looked like the beautiful way wasn't the right way, didn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, you look at that team, Falcao, Zico.
Oh, Ede.
I mean, I love Socrates. And the great story about Andy Mitten, the Man United fanzine, United We Stand, was going to do his autobiography, Socrates. When he turned up in Brazil, Andy, on the Friday, I think it was, and he's supposed to meet Socrates, and he never turned up till the Sunday in the hotel. And he said, "Where have you been?" And he turned up with Zico, and he said, "We love the carnival. We love the women."
It's a good excuse, isn't it?
It's a tough call, that one, isn't it? Meet a mank about your life story or go dancing for 48 hours, yeah.
Unfortunately, he passed away, Socrates, before he could
Peter, I just want to quickly go back. It's always interested me, the connection. I know the cop sang Celtic and Rangers. Liverpool, of course, famously was considered at its birth a Protestant club, wasn't it? But it's become strangely enough much more affiliated with Celtic in many ways the last 20, 30 years because of the Never Walk Alone and Kenny Dalglish, and obviously after Hillsborough, the game that was played there. It's interesting, that, isn't it?
There's there's been a lot of studies on this, on the if there was any sectarian leanings on both sides, because it's a bit of a myth, a bit of a rumour, really, you know. Mm. But there was, I went to a lecture once by someone who'd studied every minute of every board meeting from 1878 with Everton when they started to, you know, to the modern day, and he can't find any evidence of any sectarianism. So he said, yeah, it's an urban myth, and it's an urban myth. And a lot of my family were, you know, Catholics and Liverpool fans, and that, and they were Dockers. So, yeah, you know, it doesn't fit. It become a bit of an urban myth. I think maybe a lot of, there's been books written about it, and they can't decide because there's no evidence, you see.
Yeah.
But I think in the 50s, Everton had a lot of Irish players, you know. And certainly the school I went to in Bootle, same school as Jamie Carragher, by the way.
Nice.
Stadio Salesian, it was called Salesian when I was there. Most of our priests went to Everton matches, you know. So I don't know whether it was just that they invited them in or whatever, you know. But it seems to be a bit of a myth, but, you know, Evertonians cling to it, you know, as something.
Yeah. As a, you know, it's interesting. I love that story with Shankly, where they went, he supported Celtic and Rangers as a boy because he just loved football.
Yeah.
And of course he did. And he was Bill.
And he's a brilliant diplomat.
And you would just go, of course he would. You just wanted to go and watch football, yeah. Bill, did you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's it. One of his quotes was he doesn't care about sectarianism, care about religion.
No.
He just wanted to see it. And I think that's what a lot of people's attitude in Liverpool was. In fact, years ago, we used to sell the end at Everton matches as well.
Wow.
And you know, it went out. People didn't know we were Liverpoolians. The cartoonist was an Evertonian, but most of the rest of us writers were Liverpoolians. But it didn't seem to matter in them days. I think it's all changed since the Premier League and all-seater stadium, and, you know, a lot more segregation in that respect. But, you know, I wouldn't dream of going to an Everton match now because I couldn't get in anyway.
Yeah.
Because it's all there, isn't it? You know, so it's the rituals have changed in that respect. Yeah.
That is interesting, Peter. I just want to touch on that. People talk. I mean, you were considered not close, but Everton Liverpool fans late 70s, early 80s did sort of socialise together, didn't they? And meet and things.
That's all finished.
Has it?
Yeah.
Some of the older generation, I still meet Evertonians on Derby Day, and some of them come to our pubs. But I think the younger generation, that is, you know, finished. It's finished, and there's a lot of bitterness and a lot of. I think if you're looking at Everton, I mean, we spoiled their lives, didn't we, as Liverpoolians? We won, you know, the Milk Cup final 84, FA Cup final 86, 89. And they were always looking for reasons when the Premier League started of why they weren't successful. And, you know, I think it's down to their board decisions rather than being banned from Europe or whatever. But they'll always bring that up. But Heysel was never mentioned until about 10 years after Heysel, because there was a solidarity there before. During the 80s, there was solidarity between Liverpool and Everton fans because they were against Thatcher, basically. That's what
right.
it was, you know.
Right,
yeah.
The 86 Cup final where everyone, you've got it on YouTube, everyone singing Merseyside.
Yeah, yeah.
Also the City Council. So it's very complicated, and there's no easy answers. But I just know for a fact that the younger generation, it's changed, definitely. I think in our day, it was more down to fashion. Liverpool fans wore the same type of clothes, cagoules and training shoes and that type of thing. And it was crossed over a lot, you know.
The cultural thing, yeah, fascinating. Very big.
Absolutely
yeah.
fascinating.
I went to Paris, the European Cup final, and out of 10 lads I went with them, three of them were Evertonians.
Really?
You know,
For the
jolly, didn't they? Yeah,
that's brilliant. I love all that football social history, as I call it.
This is the Best 11 podcast from Talk Sport.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is the Best 11 podcast with Johnny Owen and Mark Webster.
Right, Pete, here's the big question. This is the one. This is your best Liverpool 11. Really difficult, we know, for Liverpool fans. A bit like Man United fans. I don't know, it's an embarrassment of riches for you, but we're going to have to make you pick your favourite 11 and manager of that team.
Yeah, have I got to say why I picked them all?
Listen, you tell us, elaborate why.
You can have as long as bench as you want as well, which
I think the squad would be big, wouldn't it, really?
Well, me in goal, it's got to be Ray Clements.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Clements, who's absolutely brilliant. And, you know, obviously, Alisson is pushing him hard. And if Alisson in the next few years, if he's carries on the way he is, you know, it will be Alisson in a few years' time. But I think for me, Clements.
It was a permanent battle between him and Peter Shilton at the time for the England number one, wasn't it?
Exactly. And Clements probably didn't get as many caps as he should have done simply because
of Peter Shilton existed in the side. And even Ron Greenwood couldn't decide because he used to alternate them for games, didn't he?
Yeah.
I think, you know, I mean, it's one of them. I think when you look back to your childhood, it's nostalgia as well, isn't it? You
know? Yeah, so, of course.
Yeah. And the next one, you've got to go for Phil Neal, haven't you, right? Ooh, back?
I mean,
I had this with Stephen Graham. You leaving Phil Neal? That's a big because he won four European Cups.
Right? It's a massive shout because Phil Neal's the most. He's got the most medals ever, doesn't he? As a player, you know, so you can't disregard that. Also, his nickname taking penalties was Zico. So always a great penalty taker. So I was tempted to put Trent in because I think Trent's an unbelievable footballer.
Yeah.
But I think I had to go with
Stephen Graham endeavoured to change his 11 by text after the interview.
Yeah, he did.
He was sweating over it, trust me, Pete. Yeah.
That's great. So in goals, Ray Clemens, you got
Phil Neal right back.
Carry on, mate. Yeah.
Then it's Van Dijk.
That was my guess.
Van Dijk, he's going to be on every best 11 Liverpool team ever. Even if he disappeared now, because he's just transformed the team so much. You know, just been unbelievable. And then Alan Hansen.
What a partnership that is.
Yeah, that's some silky football there, isn't it?
And they can both defend and bring the ball out. Do everything you want really from a centre half partnership.
So another very difficult one because I think Robertson's right up there looking for position. But if you look at the team that who have picked, it's Emil Hughes, you know, because he transformed the team as well in the late 60s and early 70s. And his nickname is Crazy Horse, and he just transformed the attitude of the team, you know. Magnificent player, you know, and Robertson's up there, definitely.
Yeah,
maybe in two or three years, you never know.
We've struggled with left backs, you know. We've had some decent ones, but I think for me, Robertson's got, you know, he's Joey Jones with a bit more skill, you know. He's got an attitude, and he's never said that. And I wanted to pick him. But I think I've got to go with Emil Hughes. Yeah.
Obviously, I'm putting Julian Dix on the bench.
Of course, he is. I was going to say that. I was going to say if he's on passion alone, Joey Jones will be captain.
Emil Hughes had a great song, but Manfred Mann, come on with it. You're not seeing nothing like the mighty Emil.
That very nearly scans as well. So Pete is in. Yeah, definitely.
We'll take that. So we're into midfield, Pete.
Midfield, well, my holding midfield player is Graeme Souness.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing's getting past Graeme Souness. And the very fact that, you know, he's obviously over the years, you know, I don't think Souness thinks that Liverpool fans love him, but they do. I think, you know, there's big debates on forums whether there should be a flag for Souness, you know. So, yes, Souness, onto the right of Souness, and although Gerrard didn't like playing on the right, Benitez had him, famously had him on the right for a bit. I'd have Steven Gerrard just to the right of Souness. Okay. And what a magnificent player. He, you know, just so sad that, you know, he's remembered for that slip, and, you know, he dragged that club with him for 15 years. You know, he just
The team on his back at times, and I know that to West Ham's chagrin, obviously, and, you know, but there were moments when it would just become incredible to see one man kind of lift an entire.
I literally seen that. They played Cardiff in the League Cup, beat them 2-1, and Cardiff had the audacity to equalise. And literally, you know, like in a schoolyard, Liverpool put the ball down. Gerrard picked the ball up and went past the ball and scored. And literally did that, as if he was like, "All right, I'm annoyed by this now."
Yes.
I was thinking, "Dear me."
Those famous games, the one against West Ham, the FA Cup, 2006, was it? Yeah, when he scored. You know, absolutely. I mean, I was right behind that with me lad, and I thought, "What's he shooting from there for?" And then it just came towards us. We had to, even though it was going in the net, we ducked. And
Olympiakos game. Remember that Olympiakos game in the Champions League? Fantastic.
What a hit, son. What a hit that one.
Yeah.
And also in Istanbul, when he scores the header and he just gets the ball off the net, he's going, come on. You know, just unbelievable. You know, fantastic player.
Catalyst of a player,
To the left of Souness would be John Barnes.
Lovely.
Nice.
I love John Barnes, watching him in his pomp, in that hole that he played in, which was not quite on the wing, not quite, you know, not quite halfway line. It was sort of in this space that he used to play. And they used to take the ball to him, didn't they, in those days, Pete? It was give it to Barnesy.
He lost his pace because his Achilles went, didn't he? He was playing like Dunga in them days. Remember Dunga from Bill?
Yeah.
Midfield, and he was absolutely brilliant. I can't remember him misconsoling the ball in the middle of midfield in like 8 years or whatever, but he'd lost a bit of his pace, so sometimes the crowd were a bit harsh to him. But I think if you've got Souness holding, you've got Barnes there, he can go down the wing as well, you know.
True.
Yeah. So he just couldn't get the ball off him. People couldn't get the ball off him. I remember him. We used to go in the corner of the cup in those days. We were a bit older. On the Cameron roadside, I still call it the Cameron, it's called the Centenary or the Kenny Dagley stand now. And Barnes would just walk towards players. He wouldn't sprint towards them. He'd walk to them and put it through the legs and get it on the other side. You know, it was just incredible stuff. It was Brazilian football, you know, that we'd never seen at Anfield before. You know, fantastic.
Great show. John Barnes in there.
Yeah, so then behind me front two, I'd have Dagleish. Dagleish is
going to that's not happening, is it? Is Liverpool fan putting Dagleish in their best 11?
No. Well, that's a shocker.
You know, I'd play him just behind me front two, and just the intuition of Dagleish, everything he did.
What a player.
He had time on the ball again. And, you know, it just seemed to be natural for him, and everything seems to be slow motion with Kenny Dagleish. Nothing was rushed. He had time on the ball, and It was just an unbelievable football.
And brave. I said, we were talking this to Stephen Graham. John Robertson says to me, when he played for Scotland, they used to get on his back a bit at Scotland because they expect him to be like he was in Liverpool, but he didn't have the players
around.
Didn't have Ian Rush for a start. And he was saying that John Robertson, he never shied away from the ball. Didn't matter what kind of game he was having. He said, Kenny would always go, I'll have it. And he said, I loved him for it. He said, he was the bravest player I ever played with.
Yeah. Give him the ball.
Yeah.
You know?
Great, again, not
a pacey footballer.
No.
And not a big man, but tough, and always ahead of the game. Yeah. It's incredible to watch.
Just a brilliant, brilliant footballer.
Yeah.
So, my strikers would be, and another really difficult one because I wanted to get Mane in there.
You're playing eight up front, aren't you? That's what you're saying.
You could, couldn't you? Liverpool's players.
It's not a 82 team, no. it's obviously got to be Ian Rush, you know, greatest goal scorer the club have ever had, in terms of statistics and that. I'd shave his moustache off.
But he wouldn't be the same. He's like Samson. His strength is in his moustache.
Definitely.
But unbelievable. And the time he scored four at Goodison in the derby that time.
Yeah, I remember it very well.
Rush scored one, Rush scored two, Rush scored three, and Rush scored four, you know. And so he'd have to be in the team, you know. And he's Absolutely fantastic.
Do you know, it's a funny thing, Pete. I seen him for Wales during that era as well. And he was the record goal scorer for Wales until Gareth Bale recently passed him. But people forget, Wales didn't have a midfield. So, you know, the thing was, he was scoring goals in Liverpool when he was playing, let's be fair, with Kenny Dalglish and Graham
Smith. Pass after pass.
So he could do that. But in Wales, you know, he had Barry Horn, basically. no disrespect. But he was still our record goal scorer and only half a chance. And when he used to play, and, you know, he scored against Germany when they were world champions, I always used to think, even as a kid, well, we got a chance now. Because Ian Rush is playing. Because he could score you a goal when you least expect. It's phenomenal. Phenomenal goal scorer.
Out of nothing. I think, you know, he's one of those players who, he was when he was recommended by Jeff Twentyman, who was Liverpool's famous scout.
That's right, yeah.
One of the board members come up to Jeff Twentyman after about a year and said, "Your boss is a dud there, haven't you? About Ian Rush." And Rush went in to see Paisley and said, "You know what? You know, I'm not getting a game and I'm not scoring. What do you want?" He said, just be greedy. Just got to start thinking about yourself. Just be more, you know, keep the ball more and just go for yourself." And that bit of advice transformed it. But just showed you our greatest scout ever, who was Jeff Twentyman.
Yeah.
And he was the beginning of the demise of the boot room when he left in 86.
Yeah.
He was getting told by directors who didn't have a clue about football, "Your ball is a dud with Ian Rush."
Yes.
The greatest goal scorer of the club's ever had.
That's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
One spot left.
Sorry, Pete.
One spot.
One to go. And I think just the most natural finisher I've ever seen. It's got to be Robbie Fowler.
I knew he was going to say. Or God, as you call him on Moosey's.
Local boy. You've got to have someone, you know, Fowler. For me, when I first saw him play, it was like our Maradona. He was just unbelievable, you know. Couldn't get the ball off him. It was all left foot. It was, you know, the way he turned and everything was natural. I think anyone who's ever coached Fowler says you couldn't coach him. He was like that as a kid. He's a bit like Rooney in a way, uncoachable.
Right.
I think a great quote from Ferenc Puskas, isn't it? It was one of my favourite football quotes, is, "I thank my father for all the coaching he never gave me."
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a great line from Brian Clough. I know Nottingham Forest were your big rivals, but they said to him, how do you coach John Robertson? And he said, "It's very simple. I say, I'll meet you 2:45, bring your boots."
Yeah.
And it's so true. You don't coach those kind of players.
Let them do their thing.
And I think, Robbie Fowler was just an absolute natural, wasn't he? Like, same with his left foot.
I'll tell you the nice thing as well, Pete, about this is that, I mean, you've got Van Dijk in there, but if we did this again in 5 years, think of your current crop of players that you're going to have to threat over to get into your best 11.
Yeah, exactly, and I was saying, I've said on interviews in the past, you know, few months before the end of the season, really, that, you know, not many of the old squad would get into the new team.
Yeah.
It shows you how you know, a few weeks without football, you change your opinion, you know, but obviously I think Mane and Salah are exceptional players, and Firmino, but I think you've got to have people who were there for so many years.
Yeah. Listen, that's not a bad front line. Dalglish, Rush and Fowler is not a bad front line.
I think they paid their dues. I really do. Yeah.
There's a few European cups there, yeah.
Imagine a defender seeing that, you know, Dalglish behind Fowler and Rush. You think, what am I going to do? You know?
Yeah, it's actually fun.
Get past them and you've got a... You got Souness to take the ball off you. You know?
Yeah, exactly. True. I was going to so just as difficult a question, I think, because, you know, you've got with Klopp three, I mean, top managers. But who would manage that team?
It's really hard.
It's tough,
my heart goes with Bill Shankly.
Yeah.
And my heart goes with Bill Shankly, but my head goes with Jürgen Klopp.
Yeah.
My heart is, because I grew up as a kid idolising Shankly, you know, everything he did, every utterance out of his mouth, everything about him, you know. But I think, I think I've got to go with Klopp. And one of the main reasons I've chosen Klopp is because, not only because of his celebrations, but he's, because everything about him, you know, he is very similar to Shankly in many ways. His enthusiasm for football knows no bounds. It's unbelievable. And he's very similar. You know, we got a goalkeeper, a centre, a spine of the team that Shankly always used to talk about. But I think in terms of Klopp, you know, I think that emotion that he shows, the celebrations, and the fact that he's taken on Pep Guardiola, who's probably one of the best managers ever, no doubt about that. And he's inside Guardiola's head, isn't he?
He's the perfect fit, isn't he? A bit like Shankly going to Liverpool, and the great quotes from Shankly, you know, I knew the crowd was you, I knew the people were you, they were my kind of people. All those things Shankly said that, you know, that he brought the best out of the city and that the love they
Klopp's
had.
Klopp's
done the same thing, hasn't he, really?
You know, I think even begrudgingly, Evertonians I know, Man United fans I know, who absolutely despise Liverpool, they've got a grudge and respect there for Klopp, because they know if they'd have been at their club, you know, they would have transformed their club as well. Because if you look at the situation, Liverpool under Rodgers, we were, you know, we nearly won the league 2013-14. I think, as I've said to you in the past, if we had won the league, Rodgers might have been given more time, but Klopp is the real deal. Everything about him, you know, and you could see it with the celebrations. You know, he looked like a German football fan. He had a scarf around his Metallica on the back of his jacket.
I know that's why Pete's picked him. He's a better dancer than Bill Shankly. It's it.
But not a better dancer than John Toshack.
No, of course, John Toshack still rules. We know that. That's true.
And he likes music, He likes music. He's famously said there's certain the heavy metal football
that's
he talked
right.
about.
Heavy metal football.
He's got mates, I think, in bands in Germany. And I've never met him in any way. A bit like John Peel said, he never wanted to meet us. I never really want to meet him, if you know what I mean.
Don't want
to ruin it.
Leave it that he's on this thing. Pete, absolutely fantastic, mate. I mean, that was superb. And it's so difficult doing a Liverpool best 11, I always think, because so many great players to pick from and managers. I mean, Bob Paisley as well has got to take a mention,
exactly.
Hasn't he?
Yeah. But, I think in terms of personality,
yeah,
it's got to flop, hasn't it? I mean, Paisley was brilliant, but he didn't like, he was shy, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I think in the modern media world,
he
would have struggled to cope with things.
It would have been difficult for him.
He would have taken, he would have been made up with the modern media.
Shankly would have been on the telly every day, wouldn't he? What was the name of the little, you had a little journalist called Horace something, who was at the... a sleepy provincial club, as Horace says. And then Bill Shankly arrives and he says, every day I used to run in with a little notepad, because he'd call him
into
the office.
Career.
I'm going to tell you, Horace is suddenly flying around Europe within a few years. Yes. Fantastic.
I don't think they knew what they were getting in Liverpool Football Club. I think they were in the second division and they were getting good gates. But he was an absolute whirlwind. He had all the staff painting the ground, didn't he? And fixing the toilets and, he it was collectivism. It was like, and that's what Klopp's got as well. It's not phony. You see, when he went back with the European Cup, he went round to all the tea ladies and all the cleaners and he's hugging them. You know, it must be a nightmare for him now not being able to hug people.
Brilliant. Pete, thanks so much, mate,
cheers,
for joining
mate.
Us. You've been a legend, top man. And we'll speak to you soon, okay?
The
Best 11 podcast from Talk Sport.
Thank you for listening to the Best 11 podcast. Don't forget, we've got new episodes out every Thursday. So join us for more football memories and another Best 11 very soon.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.